Hope you're having a fantastic Thursday, one day away from Friday, so that's always a good thing. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to start with Windows 7 talk. Are you an Apple person or are you a PC person? And if you've had Windows 7 and didn't upgrade, you're out of luck because it's rest in peace, Windows 7. To talk about it with us is Jason Heiner. He is the editorial director at CNET. Hi, Jason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Fantastic to have you with us. So there's a lot of talk this week about Windows 7. I am an Apple person, so just explain what's been going on.
Yeah, so Windows, you know, there's various versions of Windows, and they come out, the numbered versions have come out, you know, years apart. The newer versions, Windows 10, has come out much more like Apple. You know, they release a couple updates a year. In Windows' case, you know, Apple releases one big update a year. But, you know, the old version of Apple, or of, Microsoft Windows, is Windows 7. That's the one that's still on a lot of computers out there that haven't upgraded. And, you know, yesterday, I should say Tuesday, was the last day that Microsoft supported Windows 7. So they're no longer sending out security updates and patches, and they're no longer supporting consumers if they have questions with Windows 7. Now, that doesn't mean your Windows 7 machine is going to stop working. It'll still work fine. It just is not going to get the latest security update, so you're kind of on your own. You have to be even more careful about security, and if you have problems, you can't call Microsoft anymore.
This shouldn't have come as a surprise to Windows users. I feel as though they had been warned, right?
For sure. So, you know, it's been since 2015 is when Windows 10 came out, and Microsoft offered a free upgrade from Windows 7 to Windows 10 for a year. And then there's kind of the wink, wink, nod, nod, where that free upgrade is still around. And so there's an article on CNET that can show you how to get the free upgrade. Even if, you know, you didn't when it first happened, you can still upgrade from Windows 7 to Windows 10. And if your Windows machine is old enough that it can't really run Windows 10, it's just too slow, then we also have some an article that went live today that'll give you some recommendations on which machines are best to upgrade to.
Is there one that you prefer? I see the article says 5 mainstream laptops to replace your old one if you use Windows 7.
Yeah, you know, all of those are winners. Our team reviews a lot of laptops. You'll see on that list, one of them is a MacBook Air. That would be the most radical move. Although, you know, Chromebook is on there too. That's also not a Windows machine. But if you want to stick with Windows, there's some good machines from Microsoft, from Dell, from HP, from Acer, and others. So, yeah, we have lots of good recommendations if you're ready and it's time. Or if you just, maybe it's not quite time to upgrade from Windows 7 to Windows 10, but you're like, okay, this year is the year, then you can sort of look at our advice and you can start planning for when you want to do that. Maybe after you get your tax refund or something.
A lot more to talk about with editorial director at CNET, Jason Heiner, including tiny living robots made from frog cells that could soon swim inside your body. So you definitely want to stay tuned for that. The Wintrust Business Lunch with me, G. We're talking with Jason Heiner. He's the editorial director at CNET. Jason, before we move on, I just wanted to mention there is one security issue with the new Windows 10 that was just recently discovered. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, so the NSA, that's the U.S. National Security Agency, discovered a flaw, a very serious flaw. So they put it out there publicly, and we have to assume that they put it out there publicly while, you know, they told Microsoft about it, and then both of them went public with it, because they wanted the awareness to be out there from users to patch this as soon as possible. It was that dangerous, because it makes something that you think is secure, so it's a way of that hackers could use to fool you to thinking something is secure, like a web page or an email, that isn't. And so basically all you have to do is update Windows 10, and there's a patch out there that fixes this. But if you don't, then you're vulnerable to a pretty serious attack that the NSA discovered and then Microsoft patched pretty quickly this week.
The message here is to always keep your software updated. It helps with security on every level.
For sure.
I know that the Consumer Electronics Show just wrapped up a few weeks ago, but you discovered a lot of new technology that involved foldable screens, whether it was for your cell phone or a rollable television screen as well. And you've got some news on a foldable phone screen made of diamonds.
Yeah, so you think, well, that must be expensive. But actually, this is a foldable screen using diamond glass. So it's very thin and very hard. You know, diamonds are one of the hardest materials in the world.
They're also a girl's best friend.
Right, of course. So the cool thing about this is one of the biggest challenges that foldable devices have faced is that they're made from plastic screens, whereas most of today's screens are made from glass. So they haven't been very durable. There's the very famous problem that happened with the Samsung Galaxy Fold, one of the first foldables to come to market. It had some real durability issues even when it first launched. Some of that's been improved, but it's still the biggest question hanging out there is, you know, can we have these foldable devices that give us more screen, more room to work, more room to view things, but fold up into a smaller package? It feels like that this could be part of the future of phones, but that issue of that screen folding is a big one. So this new material, diamond, based screens that are very thin and very tough, much more like glass, is a really interesting take. And the company that does it is a competitor to what you may have heard of, the Gorilla Glass made by Corning, which is on a lot of the highest-end smartphones. So CNET's still working on this. We're going to do some of our own torture tests with it potentially, and we'll see how it holds up.
So not quite the bling-bling I was picturing, but it's lab-manufactured nano diamond materials. And how expensive is this going to be? Is this phone going to be super, super pricey?
Yeah, we don't know yet. It's still, in process. But I think they know that if they want this to be a product that's going to be, you know, the glass itself that's going to be in a lot of phones, it's going to have to be down around the same price as today's glass or plastic screens. So we'll see. If it's going to gain traction, they'll have to be in that same range.
Jason, I mentioned this earlier. I am fascinated by this. Tiny living robots made from frog cells. Gross, first of all, I have a fear of frogs. Could soon swim inside your body. Why do we need this? And how is this even possible? And why do I want it in my body?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. So this comes from researchers at the University of Vermont and Tufts University. They used a supercomputer to basically design these programmable living cells that, like you said, they come from frog embryos. They're incubated, and the interesting thing is it's sort of a cluster of cells that has kind of some leg-like things so they can sort of swim. But they call them xenobots, so they're not robots in the technical sense, but they are programmable sort of living cell bots. But the whole reason to do this is that one day these could be used to, you could put them into water and they could, for example, clean up toxic materials in water. They could clean up microplastics. You know, plastic pollution in our oceans, for example, is a really big problem. And these things could be programmed to help clean up some of that. So that's cool. And then the one that you're alluding to as well is they could actually be injected into humans and deliver medicine or treatment to cells and that kind of thing. You would never know except that maybe they could do some things that would be treatments for diseases and conditions and infections and those kinds of things in potentially some innovative and really creative new ways.
Well, talk about a tiny, tiny little tool. Hopefully it's not from an apocalyptic movie that we've seen in Black Mirror or something like that.
Right. You can certainly imagine it like a lot of, like all technologies, right? They can be used for good and they can be used for bad. And you can imagine also the possibility of these things being used to do damage to people and to other living organisms or even, oceans or ecosystems and that kind of thing. So, like all forms of technology, there'll have to be some safeguards put in place to try to mitigate those kinds of things.
And something we've been hearing is going to be huge for this year, 2020, electric everything, especially electric cars and self-driving cars.
Yeah, so the interest from Americans in self-driving cars and especially electric cars is really increasing. So there's a big jump. There was a study that looked at 35,000 consumers from around the world and got their responses to their interest, in these new car technologies. We saw a major jump in 2018. 29% of people in the U.S. were interested in an electrified car as their next vehicle. In 2019, that jumped to 41%, so an increase of 12% in 1 year. So that's a big, big jump. That does show that these things are gaining traction and are in demand. It's why you see all of the major car makers really rushing to develop and perfect the electric cars that they're putting out. And then another interesting one was the idea of autonomous cars, self-driving cars, and other kind of autonomous vehicles.
Folks not as happy about that, right? Rosy of a picture.
No, and it makes sense. We've been talking about electric cars really for about a decade, pretty consistently since Tesla came out with the first really serious electric vehicle. Driverless cars, self-driving cars, much less time, right? It's only been the last few years. And you see that in this study, only, in terms of most Americans anyway, 58% wouldn't pay more than $500 extra, right? They're not going to sort of pay a lot extra in order to get that feature. They're going to basically expect to pay the same, and then eventually their cars become self-driving. So we'll see if that changes over time, but there's obviously a lot of interest in these new technologies and cars. It's one of the things this decade that we expect to make a big impact on our communities and on the ways that we get around. So it'll be important and interesting to watch.
I think you're right about that, Jason. It seems a lot of my friends and family don't want to give up that control when it comes to driving. They don't want a self-driving car, that's for sure. Thanks so much to Jason Heiner, who is the editorial director at CNET. Right now, we're going to have a lot more coming up on WGN Radio. Thank you for staying with WGN Radio. This is the Winter's Business Lunch. G here, joined now by Jeff George, who's a principal and international service leader at Baker Tilly Practice Firm. If you own a small business, but you're not thinking on a global scale, Jeff says that you should be. And he helps Midwestern businesses expand overseas. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, G. Thanks for having me.
So why should smaller businesses be thinking globally?
There are lots of reasons, but the primary one is the opportunity to capture growth internationally that maybe at home might be potentially a little bit tougher to get. Maybe it's a sector where a company might be facing some stiff competition. Maybe its sales have plateaued. And yet overseas, you have markets that are growing sometimes three times faster than the U.S. and are clamoring for products that are U.S.-made or have a U.S. stamp on it.
So how small of a business are we talking?
size, and that's one of the things I think so exciting and fun about international markets, is they don't really discriminate on the basis of size of a company. It's really about the fit of a product for a specific market and geography, and that's something that we help our clients identify and make sure they only make the bets where it makes sense.
Is that one of the misconceptions that you find that business owners and operators have in terms of thinking globally?
Unfortunately, it is. Often we see many companies and the leaders in those companies exhibit what we call a self-limiting mindset. They believe that international growth is great for other companies, but they don't see themselves as being companies that can take advantage of that. Or maybe because they've never done it before, they believe they perhaps shouldn't attempt it. And so our research shows that there's actually significant demand in markets abroad for even mature products or for small company products to the tune of sometimes growing a business by, you know, eight figures in 18 months, as we've seen with some of our own clients in the Chicago area.
I'm talking with Jeff George. He's a principal and international service leader at Baker Tilly, and he basically helps a lot of Midwestern businesses expand overseas. What if someone feels as though their product isn't as unique or new? Is there still a market for a product that's not necessarily dramatically disruptive to the industry?
Great question, G. And the reality that we find in our experience is you don't need a breakthrough product to experience breakthrough growth abroad. Sometimes, as long as you're just more differentiated than the local players, because it's difficult to beat the local folks at their own game, but if you have a little bit of a different spin on the basis of the local competitors, you bring an enhanced brand, perhaps you have a different voice into the same market, all those things together can position a product that isn't breakthrough in nature to achieve breakthrough growth for a company abroad.
So if you're having trouble picturing this, can you give an example of a couple of businesses that you've helped here in the Midwest expand globally and what they are selling?
Sure. I'll give you an example. We have a longstanding client is actually a company based in Chicago. They provide industrial systems. They go into infrastructure and the development of grid and electricity delivery. And you would think that a company that's been around for as long as they have, doing something that is very mature, probably would have kept their national growth as what they've seen in their last, call it 50 or 80 years of operation. But what we found is in conducting research is that there were markets that they themselves were going through expansion and needed the product that they offered. So we were able to identify and unlock markets such as India, Turkey, Czech Republic, Finland. And the Chicago-based company has, in the span of 18 months, gone from zero sales into those countries to a combined almost $20 million.
That is so cool. But how do you figure out which markets are open to your products?
Great question, and it's really about a fit, right? So we often get the question, what's the best market to enter right now? And the answer is usually a question back, what do you do as a company? Because it's really specific to the fit of what your company does to the right market for it. We find that the way that we go about it is to really align markets that are growing with a specific product or specific service. And we take a very surgical approach in helping our clients break through the grain from the chaff and focus on what matters most, make that alignment, and then deploy it on their behalf and help them grow.
And Jeff, global economics has a role in this because there's a growing middle class in a lot of countries.
Mm-hmm. It does. And as you'd expect, these growing middle class economies are having the appetite, both figuratively and literally, for what these innovative, inventive, entrepreneurial companies that we have in the U.S. and in the Midwest to provide products to fill that demand. You know, you think about, for comparison purposes, right, the U.S. economy is growing, most recent indicators, at about 2% gross domestic product growth. And that rate is what we would call moderate growth. Anything that's flat would be between 0 to 1%, and then anything that's negative would be an economy in contraction. So the U.S. for the last quarter of 2019 grew at 2.1%. Now compare that to countries like India, growing three times as fast at 6.7%. Philippines, 6.5%. Vietnam, the same. Indonesia, 5.5. So these are countries that have an expanding middle class. They have increasing purchasing power. And the local players are only going to offer what the local players offer. So you come in with a great, inventive, forward-thinking U.S. product, and you do it the right way, you can get traction.
So, Jeff, to sum it up, you're saying if you're a business owner, don't think you're too small to go global.
And don't do it alone. There's no reason why hacking at this would be a recommended process. There are companies like us that are extraordinarily experienced. We become an extension of the client's team and make it happen in record time.
Well, thank you so much to Jeff George. He is a principal and international service leader at Baker Tilly Practice Firm. A whole lot coming up, including trending business stories. Wintrust Business Lunch, G here, joined now by WGN Radio's Amy Guth. Hello, Amy. How are you?
Hello. How's it going?
Fantastic. So for a while there, I was hearing from a lot of my friends that are independent contractors and or freelance workers, and they were really enjoying all the choices of workspaces that were available to them here in the city.
They're about to get one more.
They are.
Yes. So there's a Texas-based company called Firm Space. They have one in Austin, one in Houston, and one in Denver. And they have just made plans to come here. And, you know, I don't know that we necessarily need another co-working brand, but people are going to love it. What's interesting about this particular one is they're kind of high end, right? And they have a little more security. They have a lot of legal clients.
People fancier. Just,
and when I say people are going to love, people just, I feel like these fill up so quickly. You keep thinking, how can we possibly have a need for more of this? We have at this point now 3 million leased space, million square feet of leased space in the co-working realm in this city, just in the city proper. We're not talking about like outer part, just downtown, like just down here.
That's fascinating to hear because we've been hearing so much about WeWork and how WeWork's business has been on the decline and leasing activity has been plunging for them.
They made a big leadership change after their CEO and founder was invited to depart. They made a lot of changes. And WeWork
I like how you said that, invited to
invited
depart.
It's
a very nice way.
I've been reporting on a lot of executives lately, and the language is always creative like that. They don't just say, like, fire, right?
Or
it's always
you've
like,
you've been canned.
Yeah, right. It's invited to retire, things like that. Anyway, he was invited to depart, and so they've restructured a bit, and they did make some changes. There were some layoffs there. WeWork's approach has been a little more like, let's have a lot of different spaces. So if you're like a member, you can maybe float. If you need to be in the financial district in one part of your day for a meeting, and then you need private quiet office time, maybe in River North or whatever later, you can do that. WeWork kind of works that way. They even have two locations, when it's all said and done, two locations on Green Street. So you could, that have a completely different vibe in the two of them, right? So that's kind of their strategy, that you might need to pop around different areas of the city. This one, Firm Space, is a lot more, like I said, a lot of security. It's a lot more high end. So this is going to be, I imagine, a lot of like the corporate headquarters is maybe in another city and you have a smaller team here, but it still needs to be a nice and quality office. It's not going to be, you know, around a lot of startups and a lot of, you know, a different office culture. It might be a little more quiet, a little more secure, things like that.
Fascinating. Okay.
But yeah, 3 million square feet leased in Chicago, just here downtown in the co-working realm. So it's to me, I keep thinking there's going to be a bubble, it's going to burst. No, I think it is still a really interesting and attractive option for people, especially when there's a lot of questions swirling around property tax. You can have a relatively low risk commitment and have an office space. Now, the interesting part to me is the part that starts going about landlords, because most of them have a non-compete clause. So if you rent, say, you have a 20-story building and you rent two floors to one of the co-working spaces, you cannot rent anything like it in the rest of your building, right? So I think that part's really interesting because it does kind of like tie up some space for landlords. But then even landlords are starting to get into like, well, what if we were just kind of our own sort of WeWork or our own sort of spaces? So I think this is only going to continue to be interesting, but I continue to be fascinated by how quickly this space gets snapped up and how there are waiting lists. People really are on top of this.
Again, the company is named Firm Space and it's an Austin, Texas based company.
Yeah.
And it's a 15-year agreement over by Wells and Adams.
Yep. I think it's at 145 South Wells. If that's
okay.
Addresses stick in my head. I don't know why, but they do. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So that.
Well, okay. We're going to see how well they do then. That's going to be interesting to watch. Okay. And you've got some news on the 606 and the controversy there.
Yeah, this was a really interesting story to watch, too. And it has...
Well, explain what the 606
yeah,
is.
Yeah, so the 606 is this recreational trail. It's an east-west line. It was like the Bloomington Trail, right? And it's very beautiful. If you've ever walked on it, it's well-lit, even late in the evening. There's pretty good security on it, you know. There's a lot of people on it. There's a lot of bikes. There's a lot of joggers and dogs and babies and all those things,
I
right?
had a few friends that had homes close to the 606, and they were like, yes, this is going to be the 606. They were so excited about property values.
Were they
initially when it happened?
Initially, yes. Right. A lot of people were, particularly on the western end of it. So when it was built, a lot of people, so it goes on the eastern end into Bucktown and a little bit further east, and a lot of people were like, oh, sweet, my property value is going to go way up. It did not go up as much as perhaps it was predicted to. What happened on the western edge, we're talking it stretches into Humboldt Park, people were suddenly getting displaced. You know, there was a guy who stood up at a city council meeting and said, he was I think probably 11 or so when it started. And he was like, look, I was excited. My friends and I thought, here's a space we can play and it's safe and it's fine. We don't have to worry about cars. But in reality, his parents' rent went up $500 and they ended up having to move. So it's really impacted the western edge. So two aldermen made this proposal to put a moratorium on new home construction and demolition. So just to kind of give people a chance to figure out how to stem the bleeding a little bit on gentrification on the western edge, the initial proposal, there was one for 12 months, one for 14 months, and it extended quite a bit away from, like, into the neighborhoods away from the trail. There was some back and forth on this, a lot of negotiation. What it landed at this week is 6 months, and it's a lot closer to the trail, and it doesn't go as far east on the trail, but it's still something. And I think these aldermen feel like, hey, this is something. This gives us time to organize and just kind of figure out, because we can't just turn our backs on affordable housing. We can't just say, okay, your rent goes up $500. Too bad. You're going to have to move. We have to figure out a solution that's workable for everybody, but doesn't necessarily shoot economic development in the leg either, right? And still lets people. So it is about new home building. It's not necessarily about demo. So we'll see how that goes. That's going to be one to watch very closely in the next 6 months, I think. I mean, I've walked the 606 many times in the summer. It's so great up there. You don't have to like wait for the traffic light. You just keep on trucking if you're running or something. Every time I'm on it, I feel like, wow, that building just went up overnight. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, there was that cute little house, and now it's a huge condo that looks like all the other condos. You know, a lot, like, you could see that happen really fast, and I think it happened a lot faster than anybody anticipated on the western edge. So we'll see. We'll see what that does in the neighborhoods and kind of how that shakes out.
Very interesting. Amy Guth, the DePaul University study said the median sales price jumped from $97,000 in 2012 to $162,000 in 2018, and that's along the west end of the 606 trail, up 344% since 2012,
yeah.
Which is why we've got to keep an eye on the affordable housing discussion.
Right. That is not an insignificant jump, and that really does price a lot of people out of neighborhoods who've been in neighborhoods a long time. So we'll have to keep an eye on that one.
Well, thank you so much to WGN Radio's Amy Guth, always keeping an eye on all the business stories. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
A lot more coming up. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.